you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. Thank you for listening to the Twilight Histories. If you're new to our show, you might find this a little different than other podcasts. We tell stories where you are the hero. You will explore strange new worlds, some familiar, others totally exotic. Making you the main character is designed to create an immersive experience. We're trying to stimulate your imagination and surround you with the worlds you explore. These experiences should come alive to you. So listen with the lights off and allow yourself to be taken away. Before we launch into our main feature, try out this short sample story to get you warmed up. This is called Beyond the Indus, and was inspired by a suggestion by one of our patrons, Julia Joff. Enjoy. You scratch your elbow. It doesn't hurt, doesn't even itch. It's numb. You keep rubbing and scratching the red ulcer, hoping to bring your elbow back to life. The other soldiers around you are scratching their ulcers. You feel fortunate yours is on your elbow. Some have lost fingers, arms, or legs. Many have died. And yet, Alexander pushes you on. He and his officers won't even come close to the regular troops. At least those officers that haven't caught the plague themselves. Instead, they herd you from a distance like sick animals, driving you on into the unknown. I'm rich, Oropus says, yet look at me. His ulcer has eaten away his ear and is spreading across his cheek and neck. You've made a strong friendship of Oropus. You joined the army with him in Macedonia and have been fighting alongside him for 8 years. You fought your way across the crumbling Persian Empire, distributing Greek governors and urban planners to build a string of new cities called Alexandria. But you are both tired now. You both want to go home. He to his village in Macedonia, where he hopes to live like a king from his spoils. You to your world to get medical help. I think it was the river. We should never have crossed it. There's something evil about it. The Indus? Yeah, that river. It made us sick. How do you mean? He swats a fly from his stump of an ear. His pack nearly falls off, and he readjusts it, cursing under his breath. He looks old. He was so young and happy when you left Greece with him. But his face is now haggard by sorrow and ravaged by plague. What I mean is, I think the river is paying us back for all the killing we did. You remember I told you that when we crossed? I remember you said it was too large to cross and we should go back home. I said it was cursed. We walk together for a little while in silence, but you can see his lips moving. He's working something out in his head. You know, it reminds me of a story my mother told me when I was a kid. There's this river between two worlds, and it's like some sort of protective wall. When you cross it, it makes you numb. That's the exact word she used. Numb. Well, I can't feel my face and neck. I think we crossed that river. Could be, you say. You don't want to argue with him. It doesn't really matter what he believes. At this point, you just want to get out of this world. You let your thoughts drift home. Maybe thinking of home will trigger the transistor in your chip and pull you out. But of course now you're being just as superstitious as Europus. I don't like this new world we're in, he says. He pauses, as though waiting for you to ask him why. But you're too tired and you want to get back to your daydream. I don't like the mountains. They look like claws. I don't like the lizards. Why are we even here? I don't want to kill anymore. We've killed a lot, you say. Yeah, we've killed a lot. And we're rich because of it. I think Alexander wants us to march to death and take all of our spoils for himself. Yeah, maybe. You don't think so? I think that's exactly it. We're too rich. How will he get all the spoils back if everyone's dead? I don't think he's doing it for the wealth. He's doing it for conquest. He wants to own the entire world. But this is a different world. You really think that? Absolutely, I do. I've never seen lizards so big, have you? I heard they had ants as big as dogs in India, but not lizards. They're huge. That's true. And they keep getting bigger, I'm telling you. He swats a fly, then scratches his ulcers. It feels like scales. Maybe we're all turning into lizards. Do you think that's part of the curse? I don't think it's a curse. It's just a disease. But you agree about the river. We passed into a different world. Different gods live here. That river was their boundary. The valley grows more lush and hot. The heat agitates your ulcer, which seems to be growing. Everything is growing. The plants, the insects, and the lizards. The lizards are very strange. Some of them look like dinosaurs. You know, that's crazy, but they really do. At night, the soldiers huddle around fires, whispering about companions who strayed off into the bush and were eaten. Everyone is sure you're being followed by hordes of lightning-fast lizards the size of siege engines. Some companions even claim they've seen Indians ride them. Rumors pass through the ranks there's a village up ahead. You and Europus are at the back of the column, and by the time you arrive, the village is burning, and everything worth looting is gone. You see bodies of Indians littered around. Most curious are the dead lizards. They're definitely dinosaurs. You recognize some of them from books. But these have been domesticated. Some are clearly food animals locked in stalls. Others look as though they were bred for work. They're all being slaughtered by the butchers, and you're sure you'll taste them later. Are you starting to believe me now? Europus says in the darkness of the tent. About what? About the river. It was a boundary between worlds. I don't know about that. You're lying. I can always tell when you're lying. You believe me. I don't know what's going on out there. It's strange. It was the river. We should never have crossed that river. India is too far. We walked right over the edge of the earth. Listen, you've heard the talk. We're all scared. We want to go home. I was at a campfire earlier, and the companion said they were going to turn around and go home. That's crazy. Anyone who leaves the group will just get eaten by the lizards. Then we all need to go together. The whole army. Just like Xenophon escaping Persia. Tomorrow, we're talking to Alexander. We'll ask him to go home. I have to admit, that's probably a good idea. He's got to understand. Our baggage trains were eaten by the lizards. We've lost all our gold, and our food, too. We're going to starve out here. Yeah, I know. And this thing, it's getting into my throat, my eyes. How can he expect us to fight when we're rotting? I know. The gods on Olympus, I'm scared. I know, me too. So, you're in. We're going to talk to him tomorrow. Okay, I'm in. If everyone's in, I'm in. You're assembled in the clearing. Assembled is the wrong word. Amassed. The army of Alexander looks like a poor, huddled band of refugees ravaged by plague. You hear moans and curses as the sun beats down on them. The roar of beasts echoes through the jungle. Alexander refuses to come out of his tent. Rumor has it he's crying. Like a rich kid who had his toys taken away, Oropus says. The companions don't care if he cries. They're all too sick and scared, and they want to go home. By midday, your stomach is rumbling, and you're thirsty. Barbecued dinosaur meat is passed around by the cooks. The companions are too sick to line up. You get what looks like a burnt lizard finger dropped into your bowl. The claw is razor sharp, and you gulp at the thought of it ripping into your flesh. You hear the blast of horns coming out of the jungle. You hear deep roaring. The ground rumbles. What's that? Oropus says. A number of the companions stand around you, many putting hands on weapons. You stand and look at the jungle. I think we should go, you say.
Go where?
You look all around. The sounds seem to be coming from everywhere.
Form ranks,
an officer says. His words confirm the panic. Everyone who can stand is running, looking for escape. Some deeper into the group, others into the tree line. There are even a few who run into their tents. The roaring grows louder and the jungle sways. This way, you say, and grab Oropus by the arm. He follows you, running. There are screams behind you, the roaring and the clattering of metal, the smashing of trees. Look over your shoulder and see a stampede of huge, long-necked dinosaurs pounding into the clearing, crushing the companions under their massive feet, kicking them up like waves at the beach. You're knocked to the ground by the press of panicked soldiers. They step on your back. You can't pull yourself up. You turn in time to see a dinosaur thundering towards you. You roll just in time, and the man next to you is crushed. You hear the blast of horns, then a war cry. Indians in exotic armor pour into the clearing. Many are saddled on the backs of what look like huge velociraptors. They have no need for weapons, but simply direct the deadly predators towards the fleeing Greeks. You rise to your feet and run. You see Oropus at the tree line waving you on. You follow him into the jungle. You've been walking for days, hiding from dinosaurs and Indians, just trying to survive. You've lost all the companions. You're hungry and tired, but mostly you're scared.
We're never going to get home, are we?
Oropus says. He sits by the riverbank and puts his feet in the water. Probably not, you say. Let me see you. You sit down next to him and look at his eye. Can you see?
Yeah, but it's blurry out of that eye.
You think you can keep going?
I'm tired and hungry.
Me too.
You think we'll ever see home again?
No.
You know, the thing that bothers me more than anything else, it's not the curse. It's not that we're going to die in a different world. It's that we did all that work for nothing. 8 years building an empire. And what for? We lost everything. What's the point?
You take your sandals off
and dangle your feet in the water next to him. The water is so refreshing. I've been thinking about that too. The truth is, nothing lasts forever. Things come and go. I didn't come here to build anything. I just wanted the adventure. And I met you along the way, and we had some great times, didn't we? I mean, we fought alongside Alexander the Great. We fought dinosaurs. Isn't that good enough? We've lived more than most people ever will. Yeah, I guess you're right. We did have some good times. You sit together for a while. The breeze coming off the river is pleasant, and the water is refreshing on your feet, almost healing. You lean back against the riverbank and gaze up at the blue sky, the clouds forming happy patterns. I just get this feeling there's more to see, Europa says. You remember how I was right about the curse? Well, I'm getting that feeling now, but it's the other way around. I feel like there's something more for us here. There's a whole world to explore, and we've just begun. You could be right, you say, but you aren't sure you believe your words. I am right. I'm always right about these things, you know that. Well, you're right about the Indus. Then I'm right. You see something in the sky. It's coming out of the clouds. It looks like a large bronze-colored balloon, like a dirigible. It is a dirigible. There are propellers buzzing and flags flying from it. Three pterodactyls fly next to it. One of the pterodactyls begins to circle over you. A woman dressed in golden robes sits on its back. She waves down to you. As she gets closer, you see her smile. You know, Europas, I think you are right. That was Beyond the Indus, inspired by her patron, Julia Joff, and produced by myself, Jordan Harbour. If you want to hear your story idea turned into a fully realized concept like Julia's, head on over to Patreon and sign up. Your word of inspiration is the moon. So when you're in Patreon, head on over to the post with the moon in the title and add your idea to the thread. Only patrons can add ideas, so please sign up to add yours. Are you into role-playing games? A few fans are starting up a game set in the Twilight Histories universe. I'm going to join, and we're looking for one more player. If that's something that interests you, please get in touch. Now, for today's show. This is the first part of a three-part series by the fantastic Kevin Valpanesi. Today, he's taking us back to the early 20th century. To an alternate history of Korea. Please enjoy Red Joseon, Part 1.
The dawn of the 20th century was the death rattle of empires. Russia, Austria-Hungary, Germany, the Ottomans, they all fell in the aftermath of the First World War. Those nations sent an entire generation into the proverbial meat grinder and ruined themselves in the process. When the dust settled, many looked to the kings and emperors who led them to slaughter and decided they needed radical change. But that wasn't a purely European phenomenon. Powers far to the east of Istanbul dealt with such upheavals as well. China's last great dynasty, the Qing, crumbled under the weight of foreign pressure and an imperial apparatus which wasn't equipped to deal with the challenges of this rapidly modernizing world. If China, which had been an imperial power for over 2,000 years, could fall, then really, could any empire outrun its inevitable doom? Perhaps not. But those who hold the banner of empire aloft didn't raise the flag believing it would one day fall. No, the partisans of empire would do anything to preserve the world they held so dear. So it was with a tiny nation on the fringes of Great Qing. What you now know as Korea had its own upheavals in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The kingdom of Joseon suffered many of the same evils as the Qing Empire. Encroachment and outright hostility by Western powers put the lie to Joseon's territorial integrity. But ultimately, it would be the sole rising power in East Asia that eventually deprived Joseon of its sovereignty. The Empire of Japan, revitalized under the Meiji Restoration, began its own campaign of interference and outright conquest on the Korean Peninsula. In 1905, the Japanese won a stunning victory over the Russians, and they effectively took Joseon as the spoils of war. The king of Joseon, Gojong, had attempted to preserve his nation by declaring it an empire and seeking foreign aid, but ultimately, his efforts were in vain. Japan would take over, and much misery was to follow. But what if things went the other way? What if Russia emerged victorious in 1905? Might Joseon have been spared the harsh occupation by Japanese forces? And might the Russian Empire itself have held on a little longer, bolstered by a renewed international prestige and the wealth plundered from the East? Well, see for yourself. You'll find some clothes and supplies on the rack over there. Please get changed while I finish your orientation. We're sending you to a timeline where Japanese ill fortune, more than Russian military might, led to the Tsar's forces seizing control of the East. A storm of almost divine force and wrath surprised the Japanese fleet as they awaited the Russians in the Strait of Tsushima. Panic set in, and as the Japanese Navy attempted a return to safe port, there were collisions, followed by explosions. When the Russians did arrive, they found the remaining Japanese ships scattered and disorganized. The battle fought in the Sea of Japan was still a near-run thing. The Japanese Navy fought hard, and the Russian fleet was ill-prepared for the battle. Still, when the last gun fired, the only ships still above water were Russian. Japan could no longer maintain its position on the Asian continent, and so they surrendered. Russian forces quickly moved to seize every port they could, and then they moved inland, taking control of Manchuria and Joseon, outright conquering the former and making the latter a protectorate. Japan limped away and managed to secure its own borders in exchange for giving up the rights to all its territories and commercial interests in Joseon and Manchuria. By the time word of Russian victory reached St. Petersburg, the Russian army was already in firm control of these newly acquired territories. Emperor Gojong of Joseon accepted Russian suzerainty in exchange for protection of his own royal status and the rights of the elite upper class, the Yangban. Gojong was more than happy to give the Russians whatever they wanted, sending vast quantities of wealth and goods west. Tsar Nicholas II, for his part, was overjoyed. The Russian state had been teetering on the edge of destruction, faced with constant challenges to its legitimacy, many of them of the Tsar's own making. But now, seen as a conquering hero, and able to dedicate considerable resources to the army and the Okhrana, Tsar Nicholas could act every bit the absolute ruler he believed he was. None suffered under the Tsar's iron fist more than the would-be revolutionaries, the socialists, the anarchists, and anyone else looking to upend the social order. There were mass arrests and deportations. Several accused revolutionaries were packed off to work as indentured servants in the newly acquired East Asian territories, while others simply fled east, unable to find refuge in a Europe unwilling to challenge the resurgent Russian Empire. We're sending you into Hansong, the capital of Joseon, and the heart of the new Russian territories. We've set you up as an art dealer. There's a great hunger for all things Eastern among the elites of the Russian Empire, so you'll be cataloging and facilitating the transfer of those goods to St. Petersburg. Your studio is in the heart of Hansong, so you should be able to get a good read on the situation. You'll have plenty of opportunities to mingle with the upper class of both Russian and Korean society, so make the most of your time there. Now then, let's have a look at you. Very nice. You look every bit the aristocrat. You should have no trouble cutting an excellent figure in Hansong society. If I could impart one morsel of advice before you get on your way, it would be this. Keep things strictly professional. Don't fraternize with anyone who isn't solely interested in purchasing works of art. The recently arrived radicals are more numerous than the Russian authorities care to admit, and they're spreading their ideology among the citizens of Joseon as well. Having the wrong kinds of ideas is as dangerous in Hansong as it is in St. Petersburg. Now then, please step onto the platform. Have a nice trip, and do try to stay out of trouble. You sit alone at a table, one leg crossed over the other. You hold a copy of a newspaper, the Corriere della Sera, which is from Italy. It's from several months ago, and there's a photo of Tsar Nicholas II marveling at the ruins of Trajan's Forum, while the much shorter Victor Emmanuel III points to something out of shot. In the background, you note what must be the Tsar's entourage standing around like zombies, probably sweltering in the heat of the Roman summer. The headline reads, "The Victorious Emperor Marks His Triumph in Rome." You set the paper aside and bring a porcelain cup to your lips, finishing the final sip of hot coffee within. You feel the effects almost immediately, as if lightning is coursing through your veins. You turn in your seat and call out over your shoulder, "Where do you get this from?" A middle-aged Korean man with tightly cropped hair and a mustache worthy of Nietzsche stands behind the counter, taking stock of several metal containers. He looks up at you with a smile. "From Napoli, signore. My supplier sends the beans every month by ship, but if the Russians keep building that railway in Manchuria at this pace, I'll have even fresher coffee for you every week. Can I get you another?" "No, thank you. It's about time I open up the shop." You return the newspaper to the counter alongside the cup and pay the man using a handful of coins stamped with an imperial eagle bearing Hangul letters. Keep the change. The man bows to you and hurriedly sweeps the coins away. You take a moment to look around, marveling at the ornate wood columns with their Corinthian capitals and the fine craftsmanship of the chairs and tables, all decorated with floral flourishes in the corners and adorned with red velvet cushioning. It's a little slice of Italy in the heart of Hansong. You exit the cafe with a friendly ciao from the owner to send you on your way. You step out onto the wide central street and pull out your pocket watch. There's plenty of time for a leisurely stroll to the studio. You set off on your way, passing by the denizens of the imperial capital. The people are a curious lot, caught between two worlds and two eras. Some are dressed in the traditional garb of Joseon. For the men, it's white robes, socks, and sandals. Their hair is pulled up into a knot, which you can see peeking out from the kat, which is a wide-brimmed hat which one secures the strings under the chin. The women wear high-waisted skirts around layered and wrapped tops in an outfit you've come to know as the hanbok. You also see some of the men wearing robes of distinctly Eastern style in a variety of earthy tones, but instead of a gat, they wear top hats or bowlers and sport carefully trimmed mustaches like one would see on the streets of Berlin or Paris. Few of the women stroll around in ornate dresses with massive skirts and waists pulled tight by corsets. It's a little chilly out, so a few people are sporting double-breasted great coats, and others wrap expensive furs around their shoulders. As you round a corner, you spot four men carrying a litter, in which you see the sagely visage of an older man with long, flowing hair and a stern look about him. Meanwhile, a rickety streetcar rolls by in the other direction, carrying several of the well-to-do residents of Hansong, as well as a few Europeans, mostly men in wool suits. And nearing the studio, you see several soldiers, all of them natives of Joseon, escorting two men from out of a nearby building. It's not lost on you that several of the soldiers hold rifles with bayonets much higher than they should, all of them aimed in the general direction of the two fellows they are accosting. You approach a man of Joseon wearing a top hat and give him a gentle tap on the shoulder. Excuse me, what's going on here?
They are Japanese. They refused to close their shop after the Emperor ordered all of the Japanese to leave the country. Good riddance. Let a man of Joseon take the shop. They have no business here anymore.
Don't you find that a bit harsh?
Why should I? They've been making trouble in Joseon for decades. I'm glad the Russians gave them the beating they deserved. What? What sort of look is that? If you feel sorry for them, you can go and say something to the soldiers over there.
Oh, no. Good day, sir. You shuffle off, glancing back to see one of the Japanese men spill the contents of his trunk out onto the street. He gets a firm slap from one of the soldiers and is dragged away by the collar of his shirt, leaving his belongings behind. You arrive in front of your shop, a two-story building just down the road from the American legation. You pull a hefty key ring from your pocket and proceed to unlock three locks on the front door. That done, you prop the door open and proceed inside. The first floor is a wide open room with wall-to-wall shelves on the sides and back of the room. The shelves are lined with luxury goods, mostly fine Korean ceramics, as well as statuettes in gold and scrolls upon scrolls upon scrolls. Every item has a little label, and all look immaculate as the soft morning light penetrates through the barred windows. You do your rounds, inspecting every item, ensuring that each one is as you left it, and moving them ever so slightly to ensure that they show their best side. Satisfied, you pull out your pocket watch and check the time. It's hardly been 5 minutes since you arrived. You shuffle about, and after a few minutes, you run up the nearby staircase and into your personal study. Up here, there are several books, scrolls, and items in less than pristine condition. You search around your small desk and find a copy of Voltaire's Candide. You pick up the tiny folio, paying little attention to the leaflets underneath, many of them printed in either Cyrillic or Hangul. Almost all of them bearing the names Marx and Engels. You hear footsteps downstairs, followed by the usual Korean greeting. Annyeonghaseyo! You rush downstairs and find a well-to-do Korean man standing there in an expertly tailored suit. His hair is cut like that of an officer, and his shoes are polished so well as to almost be blinding by their glare. Curiously, the man is sweating profusely. You take a closer look and recognize him. This is Myung Sang-hoon, a frequent patron of yours. You bow to him, and he barely gives a nod back before glancing over his shoulder, back onto the street. Sang-hoon, is everything all right? He turns and shuts the door to the shop. Hey, what's going on? Sang-hoon raises a finger to his lips. You listen as the soft sound of marching echoes in the streets. Glancing out from the window, you catch the tail end of a column of police officers, all moving at a steady clip. Listen, there's not much time. The Emperor is taking advantage of the Japanese resistors to root out everyone else. You should burn whatever you have up there and be on your way. Now you're the one who's sweating. Life pawning vases in Hansong wasn't exactly as thrilling as you'd hoped. So every now and then, you've been importing literature from the West. Radical literature, by the standards of the day. You didn't think it would be such a big deal to let a few well-to-do Koreans read up on European socialist thought. I'm afraid this will be our last transaction.
Why, Sang-hoon, please, tell me what's happening.
There's no time. Listen, I need you to deliver something for me.
Sang-hoon pulls a folded note out and sticks it in your own jacket pocket.
Please deliver this note for me. The recipient will make it well worth your while.
How do I know who to give it to?
It's not sealed. Please, just do this one last thing for me.
Sang-hoon cracks the door open and peers outside. He stays like that for a long beat, watching, waiting. Finally, he straightens himself out and glances back, offering a few parting words.
I hope you found more in this than mere profit. Regardless, you have my gratitude. It has been enlightening.
And with that, Hung Soon slips out onto the street.
You open the door all the way and look for him, but he's already vanished.
You spy another group of police officers on patrol, and you decide to make good on his warning. You rush upstairs and gather your collection of contraband literature, and with haste, you grab a match and go about burning anything even remotely interesting. You hear a thump on your door, and you stomp out the last embers of a burning pamphlet. You straighten yourself out and head downstairs. Opening the door, you expect a band of police officers to force themselves in. But instead, you're met by an older Russian gentleman and his younger wife. It's business as usual, so you show them both in and attend to the hungry eyes of the aristocrats. You make a mental note to lock up shop early this evening, and find a moment to consider the solitary sheet of paper that Sang-hoon entrusted to your care. You hope that the bounty is worth far more than anything your present customers might ever dream of offering you. You set down a case wrapped in cloth as you approach the counter of the cafe. The jolly owner approaches, somewhat perplexed. He gestures to a table, but you wave him off. The usual, please. While he goes about preparing your coffee, you pull a note from your jacket pocket. It's the same note that Sang-hoon gave you last night. You unfold it and stare at the few lines scrawled in Hangul. It reads, "Let winter give way to spring, and with it the crowns for the plows. Two moons, and it shall be so." You can't make heads or tails of it, but for some reason, it leaves an ill feeling in your stomach, as if you were suddenly standing on a ship in rough seas. The owner arrives with your coffee, and you take it quickly, burning the inside of your mouth. You spit a little out, and embarrassed, you reach for a handkerchief, but the owner beats you to it with a rag. "Are you all right, signore?" You clear your throat and lift your cup so that he can wipe away the rest of the mess. Yes, sorry. Not quite awake yet, apparently. Did you wake up late? If so, I'd be happy to fix another shot for you. Didn't sleep. And no, thank you. I've got quite a bit on my plate today. I shouldn't stay long. I'll just skim the paper if you have it. Nothing new from Europe, signore. But I do have something from Joson, if you're interested. He hands you a single sheet of paper covered in Hangul characters of all sizes and organized into several different columns. It's quite different from the newspapers in the West. You take the paper with a nod and give it a once-over. One line in particular draws your attention. Righteous army bands slaughter Russian soldiers in the mountains near Hansong. You slide the paper back to the owner and finish your coffee. Done so soon? No good news these days. You turn to leave, but then the door to the cafe opens and four Russian soldiers step inside. Unlike the officers of Joson, the Russians wear heavy coats in an olive tone and sport gold epaulets on their shoulders. They all have thick beards and thicker mustaches. They're big fellows too, and they plop themselves down at a table to announce their presence. You try to leave, but your feet won't move. It's like you're welded in place. Actually, I will take another. The owner quickly prepares another coffee for you before attending to the boisterous Russians. You stand there, drinking your coffee, wondering what's come over you. Before you know it, you finished your second round. The owner returns, preparing the drinks for his newest patrons. He looks over and sees your empty cup. See? I think you needed a little bit more. You nod, and then paying your bill, you try to leave. With surprising effort, you're able to turn and put one foot in front of the other. You take up your package and walk out, stiff as a board, looking straight ahead. You walk right by the Russians, and they don't even acknowledge your existence. As soon as you're out on the street, you take a deep breath. You realize you still have the note in hand. You fold it and stick it in your pocket. Looking around, you notice that the military presence seems to have doubled since you arrived. Russian soldiers are everywhere, generally making menaces of themselves to the locals, all while the police look on with indifference. You try to hop on a streetcar, but find it full of soldiers. You stand and wait for the next one, but it's also full. So, you resign yourself to walking all the way. Things are certainly on edge here in Hansong. Every block in the city is the same thing, just more and more soldiers marching about, with the monotony broken up by the sight of the poor, looting, dilapidated businesses with Japanese signage. The Russians get in on the action too, carrying off whatever they can. Apart from their mutual hatred of the Japanese, the residents of Hansong and the Russians don't much care for each other either. Mothers pull their children away from the bands of soldiers, while older men watch from shops and from gardens with eyes like tigers in the jungle. One wrong move, and things might erupt. After an hour, you arrive outside the walls of the Gyeongbokgung Palace. Thick brick walls rise up to either side of the triple gate, while the decorative hip roof curls up and out to the heavens. Several bands of soldiers stand at attention, both those of Joson and Russia. The Russians standing by the walls are dressed in their best, sporting light brown uniforms with glistening knee-high boots. They've all dispensed with their caps and have carefully slicked hair. These soldiers are very much here for show, but the rifles and bayonets they wield are very real indeed. As you approach the gate, you enter the ranks of the Korean soldiers, all of whom sport their dark blue jackets, pants, and kepi caps. You notice that only a handful of the Korean soldiers have weapons, and that they fastidiously refuse to look at their Russian counterparts. You stop at a checkpoint, and a soldier asks you your business. I'm here to deliver some porcelain to Gang Jinsu. You present the bundle for inspection. One soldier pats you down while the others inspect the goods in the case. They find nothing amiss and return your goods. You're whisked into the inner walls, accompanied the whole way by one of the soldiers. You don't mind the escort. You're so preoccupied with the beauty of the palace. You've been here a few times already, but the grounds snatch your breath away every time. As you pass under another gate, you know you're just one more gate away from the imperial seat of Joseon. Alas, the soldiers lead you to the right and into a long corridor. You exit on another part of the grounds and arrive in front of the Sujongjeon. The soldier accompanying you gestures for you to enter, and you don't wait around. You enter the Sujongjeon, finding yourself immediately confronted with absolute luxury and sophistication. This room, used by the cabinet, features gilded furniture, high coffered ceilings, and wall-to-wall landscape scenes done in silk. You nearly drop your goods as you take in the majesty of the room. You almost don't notice the man standing by the window, pipe in hand. Ah, what did you bring me today? You approach the man who is silhouetted against one of the tall windows. His haircut is tight, military. He's got broad shoulders and stands a head above everyone else you've seen so far. As you get closer, you see his wisper of a mustache and the subtle grin he wears. I hope you didn't have any trouble getting in. No trouble at all. Thank you for seeing me. It's a nice surprise. That makes two today. How's that? I just got back to Hansong from the north, and I'm told that the Japanese emissary is coming to grovel at His Majesty's feet. The man takes a long drag on his pipe and blows a steady stream of smoke. You have to enjoy the simple things in life. You set the bundle down on the gilded desk in the center of the room and open it up, laying out three porcelain vases. The man steps away from the window and walks over. You get a good look at his youthful face. It's Gang Jinsu, one of the Emperor's advisors. He takes up one of the vases and admires its craftsmanship. You can feel the note in your pocket as if it were a hot coal. You say nothing as Jinsu inspects the next two pieces. Just like in the cafe, you find yourself frozen in place. You know the letter is for him, and that you've arrived here with little issue. But then, you can't stop thinking about that cryptic message. Let winter give way to spring, and with it, the crowns for the plows. Two moons, and it shall be so. With the tension in Hansong being as high as it is, you're certain this message will serve as the catalyst for something with dire consequences. You have half a mind to simply leave the porcelain and go on your way. Jinsu peers inside one of the vases. Nothing interesting to read today. That's unfortunate. I had to bury half my library in the garden. Jinsu peers into the case you used to transport the vases. It's empty, save for some cloth used to protect the precious cargo. I don't suppose you have anything else for me today? No, I don't think I do. Jinsu leers at you, but you stand your ground. He takes another drag on his pipe and blows smoke right in your face. You know what? You can have those for free. I don't think we'll be able to do business anymore in this climate. Consider them parting gifts for your patronage. Jinsu smiles, he bows to you, and picks up one of the vases, inspecting it a little closer. Did you ever read anything you sold to us? Or did you just pass them around like these useless things here? I'm just trying to get by. Profit, then. Carrying off our patrimony for a quick buck with one hand, while selling the end to a corrupt world with the other, Bravo. Jinsu's grin is ear to ear. His pipe hangs out of his mouth while he applauds you in jest. You fix your jacket, signaling that you're ready to leave, but he places a firm hand on your shoulder.
Don't be so hasty. You're going to miss all the fun.
I really must be on my way.
How would you like to see the throne room? You've never been in there before, have you?
It's tempting, but I really should go.
Nonsense. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Jinsu grabs a bell from the desk and rattles it. The door opens, and two soldiers step inside.
Could you please escort my friend and I to the throne room now?
Before you know it, the two soldiers are at your side, gesturing for you to go. Jinsu throws an arm around you and leads you out of the Sujongjeon. He's close enough to see the first beads of perspiration forming on your brow. You hope he chalks it up to the excitement of seeing the Emperor of Joseon. But deep down, you know he's probably on to you. And you wonder what he'll do to you in front of the very seat of imperial power. You find yourself at the axis of three imperial domains. Here, Joseon, Japan, and Russia vie for control. This would-be arena, the high throne of Joseon, is spacious enough for the contest at hand. Massive red columns hold up the patterned ceiling, sporting a scene of two dragons circling around as if to guard the gateway to heaven. Undulating wood forms rise up like clouds or smoke. This is all in contrast to the stark, tiled floor. Chief above all is the Phoenix Throne upon which the Emperor sits. Raised up above the head of any other man and accessible only by a small staircase, the structure protects the sovereign. It sports a roof overhead, as if to shield the monarch from even the few rays of sunlight which penetrate the interior. Behind the Emperor is a scene of rolling mountains, symbolic of the extent of his domain. All under heaven belongs to the Emperor of Joseon. The man himself, Emperor Gojong, is hardly an imposing figure. His round head sits atop a petite frame. He keeps his hair very short and parted in the European fashion. Likewise, his mustache would make any Frenchman jealous, though his wispy beard is something more in line with that of a Chinese monarch. His manner of dress shows who really holds sway in this court. Gojong wears a white, double-breasted jacket with gold epaulets, matching this with a pair of navy trousers and more medals than any monarch might actually earn, even in the course of a token stint in the army. You recognize this look. In the paper you were reading yesterday, Tsar Nicholas II of Russia wore the same outfit as he toured Rome. Standing directly before the throne are two groups of men from Joseon. One group is dressed in a manner befitting a school of Confucian scholars. Long beards, hair done up in knots, colorful robes, and stern faces. The other group dressed in the Western fashion. Carefully combed hair, goatees, mustaches, tailored suits, and ambitious sneers on their faces. Behind the assembled leaders of Joseon are the Russians on the left and the Japanese on the right. The Russians all showed up in their finest military uniforms with gold-embroidered collars and epaulets. Almost every Russian to a man has a long, luxurious beard and salt-and-pepper hair to match. Only one among the gathered Russians is a young man, standing out by virtue of his shaved head and tightly cropped beard. The Japanese also dress in the Western fashion, sporting khaki coats and trousers. Among the Japanese, you immediately pick out the emissary. He's a middle-aged man in a fine suit, with a perfectly trimmed mustache and eyes like a fox. After much pomp and ceremony beginning the proceedings of the day, one man steps out from among the gathered leaders of Joseon and stands before the Emperor. It's Jinsu. He bows,
and receives a casual wave of the hand from the Emperor. Peha, I come before you today with a petition from the people of Pyongyang. Many have been employed in the industries of mining and forestry by Russian corporations. They have worked hard, day and night, but their pay is barely enough to meet the modest taxes which you ask of them. Fathers and mothers are going hungry after more than half a day at labor. Some waste away just so their children may have a single bowl of rice.
And what would you have us do?
The Emperor leans back in his throne, looking anything but concerned at the plight of his people.
Peha, I humbly request that you mandate a 10-hour workday and fair wages for any citizen of Joseon who puts in a good day's work.
Gojong tilts his head, glancing at someone else among the assembled representatives. He beckons for someone among the Russian number, and on cue, the young man with the shaved head steps out and approaches the throne, standing right next to Jinsu.
Your Majesty, if I may, Gong Jinsu's concerns are exaggerated. There were some troublesome heads of the mines, yes, but their excesses have since been corrected. The rest have been giving their workers a fair wage for the labor given.
Jinsu smiles and places his hand on the Russian's shoulder.
Viceroy Bulganov, if that were the case, I would not be standing here today. I've been to Pyongyang and spoken to the laborers. I even ventured up into Manchuria to see if your labor practices differed with the former Chinese subjects there. Unfortunately, it appears you Russians have applied a rather uniform policy around your enterprises. I see workers squeezed until they are little more than dust. I'm not against productive enterprise, but I think the conditions you're forcing these people to work in will soon leave you without a workforce.
It is a very costly affair to protect this country against the Japanese and any other foreign aggressors. We cannot make bullets and shells to protect you without the precious metals we extract from the ground here. And we cannot lay railroad tracks without your timber. If we are going to slow our industry, even a little, this country will be left in dire circumstances.
Bulganov brushes Jinsu's hand from his shoulder and steps closer to the throne.
What we need in the north is more security. Your Majesty, I would like to request permission to station 3,000 additional Russian soldiers in the northern reaches of your realm. I believe there are radicals spreading dangerous ideas among the workers. Some, unfortunately, are our own, but I believe they have found a common cause with the rebels here in the countryside.
There are no rebels in the countryside. There are Japanese holdouts who continue to fight in the name of their emperor. No loyal man of Joseon would ever threaten the enterprises sanctioned by his Imperial Majesty.
Enough, proclaims the emperor. Gong Jinsu, select a few notaries and return north with them. Mr. Bulganov, you may allow your soldiers into Joseon on the condition that the laborers receive an increase in their wages. The amount I leave to your discretion.
Jinsu looks ready to erupt, but before he can utter another word, the emperor signals that the matter is settled. Bulganov grins and bows, returning to the company of his Russian comrades. Jinsu bows and disappears into the sea of suits on his side of the throne.
I believe the emissary of the Empire of Japan is in attendance. I ask that he come forward now.
The fox-eyed man steps forward, his manner a little too casual. Among the gathered men of Joseon, a great murmur goes up. Gojong scoffs as the fox-eyed man makes a show of bowing to him.
Hayashi Gonsuke, at your service, your majesty.
Gojong sits up in his throne, fixing hungry eyes on Gonsuke.
How do you answer the charge that Gong Jinsu has made? What will you do about these Japanese holdouts?
Gonsuke adjusts his collar and cuffs. He takes a long beat, clears his throat, and then stands at attention in a mocking manner.
There are no Japanese holdouts.
We withdrew every single soldier from your territory per the treaty signed by the Emperor of Japan and the representatives of the Tsar Nicholas II. And by you.
We have arrested several Japanese citizens who refused to depart Joseon within the generous time allotted to them.
Without compensation for their confiscated property, if I may add, if you release them, we will see to it that they are returned to Japan at once. That is all I am within my power to do.
We will not release those Japanese citizens unless you return to us the five traitors who fled to your shores. Yi Wanyong, Yi Guntak, Yi Jiyong, Pak Jesun, Guang Zhonghyong.
And what will you do with them once they've returned to your shores?
They will be executed for conspiring against Joseon with the Empire of Japan.
Surely, you cannot ask me to send these men to certain death.
We can. And we are. Gojong leans forward even more, looking like he'll leap from the throne. You should be so lucky that we don't come and take them ourselves.
Gonsuke scoffs. I do not think your majesty would speak so boldly without the Russian bayonets arrayed behind you.
Gojong explodes off his throne. He descends the steps and gets right in Gonsuke's face, striking him with a gloved hand. It may only have been a slap, but he may as well have shot him. The whole court is aghast. The Japanese delegation rushes to their emissary, but Korean soldiers are on them immediately. Without guns, the Japanese cannot press the issue. Gonsuke fixes his hair and his mustache. He bows to Gojong and then walks to the door, not a word to anyone else. Palace guards open up the massive doors for him to leave, but he stops for a moment, turns, and calls back at Gojong.
The five. We will bring them to you. I suspect you will not have long to wait.
And with that, Gonsuke departs. Everyone else stands around, unsure of what to do. Gojong alleviates them of their confusion.
Out! All of you!
The palace guards see to it that everyone leaves the room. Everyone, except for Bulganov. He remains there, eyes fixed on Gojong. The emperor beckons for him to approach. You try to get a better look, but a palace guard grabs you by the shoulder and orders you out. You stumble out onto the palace grounds, unsure of what you've just witnessed, even if you didn't carry out your commission. This visit to the palace was worth it. You may have just witnessed the beginning of another Russo-Japanese war. You have no doubt that, whatever the case, the Russians will take advantage of this to tighten their grip on Joseon. The Japanese make with haste for the Triple Gate, clearly in a hurry to board a ship back to the islands. The Russians remain at hand, as do the Korean soldiers. From among the crowd, you spy Jinsu lighting his pipe and blowing furious clouds of smoke. You think about Jinsu's performance in the throne room. Perhaps there's more to him than the typical aristocratic flirting with socialism. But still, you're wary of the man. Gonsuke was the only one practically threatening war, but something in Jinsu's manner makes you think that he's playing at something larger himself. Concern for the common people is often a mask for self-gratification, or an easy road to power. You just can't make up your mind about him. He's not the worst person to have spoken just moments ago, but how bad he is, you can't know for sure. One way or another, you think it best to be done with him, and just be on your way. Perhaps to Hong Kong, anywhere far away from Joseon. You approach Jinsu and reach into your pocket. You offer him the note. He doesn't notice you at first, but the moment he sees the slip of paper, he's quick to take it in hand. He reaches into his pocket, but you raise a hand.
I don't want or need anything from you. I wish you well in all your endeavors, and I thank you for your patronage.
Oh, is that all?
Jinsu takes a long drag on his pipe. All right.
Have a nice long life, my friend. And with that, Jinsu pockets the note and hurries off in the direction of the Sujongjeon. You think it best not to linger any longer, so you head for the Triple Gate. 20 minutes later, and you're still struggling to find a streetcar. They're all packed with soldiers, every one of them eager for a night of drinking on the town. One streetcar rattles by, and you see that there would have been enough space for you, but the operator might not have seen you in the dim light of the lamps hanging above the street. You miss that lift, and now you're worried you'll have to walk the whole way. Hansong was tense enough during the day, but you wonder what foul mood the citizens might be in now that night has fallen. What will they make of you, a stranger in these lands? You try to force these ill thoughts from your mind, and instead focus on keeping a steady clip. But you don't get far. A man appears from the street ahead of you, a hat pulled down over his face. You freeze, unsure of what to do next. Looking around, you notice that, at least in this moment, the street is empty. Now you're really missing that last streetcar. The man approaches you, and you stay planted in place. Fear paralyzes you completely. And then, as the man comes closer, the light from a lamp above reveals the familiar lines of Jinsu's face. This brings you no relief. Jinsu pulls a pistol from his jacket and presses it against your gut while pulling you into an embrace with his free arm. Winter is at its end, my friend. Whether or not you see spring depends entirely on what you do next.
That was part one of Red Joson by Kevin Valbenesi. Make sure you're subscribed to the Twilight History so you don't miss out on the next installment. As a reminder, you have a chance to hear your idea turned into a fully produced short story by one of our team members. Your word of inspiration is the moon. Why not dream up something really mind-blowing? Go to Patreon and sign up to add your idea. The final list will be sent off to 3 of our team members, who will then get to pick which ones they produce. And don't forget, if you're into role-playing games, we still need one more person to join our game. It will be set in an alternate history of Rome. And the way the DM has described it, it sounds pretty cool. We want to start playing next week, so please get in touch fast. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.